Now, I want you to imagine that this sanctuary is a large arena and that we've all gathered here to listen to the top motivational speakers in the country. Tell us how to achieve our dreams. The final speaker steps to the podium. She takes a moment to kind of take in the masses of people that have gathered here before her. And the topic she will address is this: how to turn failures into success in business, relationships, and life. She tells a story of a person who persisted in his dream, and only after years and years of failure did he achieve his goals because he knew the importance of thinking positively and moving forward despite setbacks. She reminds the audience here that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb after 10,000 failed attempts, and it took Dyson 5,126 attempts to invent a bagless vacuum cleaner. With each point, she sprinkles in quotes like this: "Everything you want is on the other side of fear." Jack Canfield. Robert F. Kennedy said, "Only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly." Winston Churchill said, "Failure is not fatal, it's the courage to continue that counts." And he also said, "Success is stumbling from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. It's not how far you fall, but how high you bounce that counts," says Zig Ziglar. And she quotes the great Og Mandino, a fellow from the 1960s who inspired a whole generation of post-war engineers and scientists to achieve their dreams of sending a rocket to the moon. Og Mandino, short for Augustus Mandino, was a salesman who was the worst salesman ever, and he was considering suicide, and he was an alcoholic, until he turned his life around, and he wrote about it in a book called The Greatest Salesman in the World. And Og Mandino says this: "I will never consider defeat. I will remove from my vocabulary such words as phrases as quit, cannot, impossible, out of the question, improbable, failure, unworkable, hopeless, and retreat, for they are the words of fools." He says, "I will avoid despair, but if this disease of the mind should infect me, I will work on in despair. I will toil and I will endure. I will ignore the obstacle at my feet and keep mine eyes on the goals above my head, for I know that where a dry desert ends, green grass grows. I will forget the happenings of the day that is gone, whether they are good or bad, and greet the new sun with confidence that this will be the best day of my life." The audience cheers and applauds. They stand to their feet, inspired to achieve their dreams. And as they leave, they're unafraid to go out and fall flat on their faces because they've been there to hear the great motivational speakers. And on the way out, the speaker reminds them to buy her new book, Stumble Your Way to Success, for sale in the lobby, $22.95. Now, how many of you have been to these seminars? Okay, you've been to these. You know what they're like. And they do inspire us to work harder through failure. Certainly, that's a good thing to do. And there's a lot of truth in the thought that the best lessons of life are learned through failure. And so we shouldn't be afraid of it. But I wonder what Moses would have thought if he had gone to one of those motivational seminars. I wonder if that lady had shown up 3,500 years ago where he was living in the wasteland of Midian, which was located just over the ridge from nowhere. Midian is the place people go when they want to disappear. It's where they go when they want to forget. And that's where Moses finds himself as we read about it in Exodus chapter 3. Turn to there with me, if you will. Exodus chapter 3. This is a scene out of Moses' life that maybe we're familiar with, but we're going to look at it through different eyes today. Moses, Exodus chapter 3. The first verse says this: "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." Moses is in Midian, the far side of the desert. Geographically, it's only a couple of hundred miles east of Egypt. But with regard to culture and aesthetics and civilization and architecture and quality of life and climate and fashion and the arts, in every way, the tents of Midian and the grand cities of Egypt are worlds apart. Midian was a wilderness. It was a land of utter desolation inhabited by nomadic tribes. Think of it as Egypt's outback. And how did Moses come to live in this remote, isolated wasteland? Well, it was the consequence of a colossal failure. You remember Moses' story. He was born into Egypt at a time when the Hebrew people were in bondage as slaves. 400 years earlier, they had come to Egypt as a family of 70 people. That's all, 70. Remember, Joseph had gone down before. He rose to fame and power. He brought his family with him eventually. But as the years went by, people forgot about Moses. They forgot about the privilege of the Hebrew people. And instead of being honored guests of Pharaoh 400 years later, now the Hebrew people were known as Pharaoh's slaves. Moses would have been killed as a newborn were it not for the courage of his mother to set him adrift on the Nile River, where he was discovered and adopted by Pharaoh's daughter. If any child had destiny's mark of greatness on him, it was Moses. He was rescued as a Hebrew child, raised in the opulent palace of the Pharaoh. He was trained to be a top-level leader, educated in ancient Egypt's equivalents of the Harvard Business School, MIT, and Stanford. He had all the markings of being the chosen one, the longed-for liberator, the Hebrew people's best hope for freedom. But at the pinnacle of power and potential, when he was 40 years old, this royal prince of Egypt made a royal mistake. Let's read about it in Exodus chapter 2. Just turn over the page to verse 11 of chapter 2. One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his people were and watched them at their hard labor. He's 40 years old now. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people, glancing this way and that and seeing no one. He killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting, and he asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Uh-oh. Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. That was 40 years earlier. And with one impetuous blow, Moses lost everything, his privilege, his position, his family, and worst of all, his opportunity to help his people. He was a washout. At this point in life, no inspirational quote like the ones the motivational speakers of today would give could encourage him, could move him and pull him out of this pit of failure. I can just picture old Og Mandino coming up to him, you know, and saying, "Moses, you know, forget the happenings of the day that's gone. Greet the new sun with confidence that this will be the best day of your life." Moses would go, "Aw, shut up." 40 years of living under the curse of his failure. Maybe you can identify with Moses. Perhaps you know something of Moses' despair as he lived out his banishment. For 40 years, the only group of Harvard-trained leader led were a bunch of sheep. You know, bah, bah. Perhaps you know what it's like to toil under the whip of the terrible taskmaster regret. The heavy chains of insecurity and inferiority must have wrapped around Moses' spirit like the heavy chains and shackles on the hands and feet of his suffering fellow Hebrews in Egypt. "I'm a flop. I'm a loser. I lost my chance to help my people. Don't ask me to go back. I'm through being God's leader," he must have said to himself. But God wasn't through with Moses, and he's not through with you either. Let's read what happens in Exodus chapter 3. Moses is on the backside of the desert. the far side, way out in the middle of nowhere. Chapter 3, verse 2, there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire and within a bush. Moses saw that the bush was on fire, but it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I'll go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. Verse 4, when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Then he said, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. This was the point at which Moses received his calling from God, and the calling had three elements to it. The first was this, the holiness and power of God in the burning bush. This is something where Moses had never seen before. He'd never seen this phenomenon. God was a pretty incredible motivational speaker himself. He had his own pyrotechnical display showing right there, better than anything Apple's ever come up with. So he's standing before God and he realizes that this bush, and he realizes that he's in the presence of God himself. The second element of the call of Moses was the mission. Here's what God said to him. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So here it is, verse 8. So I have come down to rescue them. Notice the pronoun. I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So that was the second part. That's the mission of God. I have come down to rescue my people. And the third part is this, and he says to Moses, so now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. God had shown him his power. He'd given him his mission. I'm going to rescue my people. And then he gave him his command, go. And God's the ultimate speaker. God tells Moses what he will do. God will do the work. And he asked Moses just to simply be a part of it. Isn't that great? You know, God's at work. His power is on display. He just wants us to be an instrument in his hands. What an honor. His methods are the same for us today. He's accomplishing his will in our world. And he says to Moses, now go. Expecting Moses to go. But Moses doesn't stir. His face is still in the ground. 40 years of replaying the memory of his failure. 40 years of hearing the voices in his head. Who made you ruler over us? You had the training, the position, the opportunity, and you blew it. You're such a disappointment, Moses. Moses had left Egypt behind years ago, determining never to return. And now God wanted him not just to go, but go back. He told Abraham to go. Remember, we talked about that last week. To a new land, somewhere exciting and invigorating, an adventure, a journey without maps. But to Moses, he says, I want you to go back to the place of your greatest failure, to face the monsters in your dark past, to reenact your most horrible pain. And at this moment, all that Moses could see was his own imperfection. At times in your life, perhaps that may be all that you can see in yourself. God may be moving in your heart and your life, and he calls you to follow his son, Jesus, into places where you feel ill-equipped and under-trained and lacking experience and skills. You know, God calls you, mothers. Do you remember the moment you realized that you were pregnant for the first time? And you instinctively placed your hand on your stomach. And you were carrying inside of you this precious treasure to nurture and protect. And you said, how can I do what God is asking me to do? Maybe there had been failure in your past. How can I do this? Fathers, do you remember the moment the nurse placed your firstborn baby in your arms? The baby only weighed a few pounds, but the weight of fatherhood rested on your shoulders like an incredible, crushing weight of responsibility. And you said, how can I do what God is asking me to do? Perhaps you're a victim of someone who's been slowly abusing you, and God is calling you to stand up to this person. Or maybe the calling is to start a career or start a new career or go to school or go back to school. Or maybe go on a mission trip. We've got a mission trip coming up this next week. We leave on Sunday. And there's lots of opportunities in our church where God has opportunities for us to go and kind of stretch our wings a little bit and try something new. And one of them is to go to Mexico. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks that are going that are thinking, you know, last time I went out to Mexico, I almost got arrested. You know, I mean, I had this horrible experience. And it takes all that's within them to overcome that fear. And it takes a lot of trust for them to go to Mexico to serve down there. A lot of trust in the leaders who've been there before. I remember the first time I went, you know, I had no idea what we were doing or how are we going to get across the border or what if I do if I get lost or who's got a phone, does our phone work around here? But Wayne Rice had been before, so I trusted him. And off we went. And everything worked out great. You know, you step out into unknowns like that. But for some of us, that is a scary thing. It's a terrifying thing. And God is right in front of Moses telling him, I mean, this doesn't happen. It never happened to me. No burning bushes in my life. So here Moses is standing right, sitting, you know, bowing down right in front of God himself. And instead of focusing on God, what Moses does is what we often do, and that is focus on ourselves. It's as if the courage had drained out of him when he left Egypt and been replaced by this toxic blend of shame and guilt and self-doubt and regret. God has to pump into his veins some courage. Not only is God giving Moses a call that Moses has to trust, but he's also going to enable Moses. And this is the process of enabling him that we get to witness here. God's redirecting Moses from focusing on his failures and faults and focusing on God's power and perfection. So Moses does something really that's quite shocking. Instead of obeying God, he has a conversation with God. And the conversation goes something like this. Look in verse 11. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" Who am I? This is the first of five objections that Moses makes when God gives him the call. He says, "Who am I?" And the issue here is a negative self-image. The implied answer to Moses' question is, you know, who am I? Well, you're Moses, you were born of Jochebed, you're 80 years old. No, that's not the answer. The answer is kind of it's a rhetorical question. He said, "Who am I?" Meaning, I'm nothing. I'm a loser. Notice that God doesn't try to argue with Moses. Have you ever tried to argue with someone who really believes they're a failure? You mean, you know, you're not a failure. Yes, I am. No, you're not. Yes, I am. It goes back and forth. You don't get very far. But God says something to him very, very important here. Instead of trying to argue with Moses, he'll never win that argument. God shifts Moses' focus from his own problems and past to God's presence. And then God gives Moses a vision. He says, "I will be with you," verse 12. God said, "I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." Isn't that great? I mean, Moses is sitting there below Mount Horeb, where later on the whole tribe, the whole nation of Israel would come to receive God's law. And so God is just God who's not a part of the, you know, he's outside of time. He looks forward on the wheel of time, and he says, Look, what, and see what I see. When you bring the people out, he said, "I will be with you. You're going to worship me on this mountain. We'll do this task together. When you've brought the people out." You know, self-pity is probably one of the most destructive emotions that there is, and I know a lot about it. The language of self-pity is something that I speak quite frequently. This one person said, "Self-pity is the most destructive emotion there is. How awful to be caught up in the terrible squirrel cage of self." And that's really what it is. You're in this squirrel cage of self, and you're just going over all the things that have gone wrong to you. I'm an unlucky person. I try this and I fail. This always keeps happening to me. I just can't get out of this. And you're just on this squirrel cage going around and around and around. And God said, I'll be with you. And when this happens, you know, kind of step off the treadmill. Let's do this together. But Moses isn't through giving objections to God. The second question is in verse 13. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers who sent me to you, and they ask, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, well, what's his name? Then what should I tell them? In this objection, he's saying, well, what is your name? I don't know. And the issue here is ignorance of God. As much as Moses, you know, was out in the wilderness all these years, he really probably wasn't really connected to God. He didn't know God. He didn't know his name. Moses reveals kind of an embarrassing little secret. He didn't know God. What if his fellow Hebrews in Egypt discover this secret? It'd be humiliating. Could this have been the reason that he failed in the first place? Perhaps 40 years old, he was acting on his own. He wasn't connected with God. But God said to Moses through the burning bush, he said, verse 14, God said to Moses, if you want to know my name, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent you. It's kind of interesting in the Hebrew. There's one word that's repeated three times. The word is eyah, which means I am. When pressed by the Pharisees to explain his identity, you know, Jesus said, they asked him, who do you think you are to Jesus? Jesus said to them in John 8, he said, before Abraham was born, I am. It was a direct reference to this answer that God had given Moses, Ayah, I am. And they picked up stones to stone him. It was an obvious connection that Jesus made between himself and God. I am the same God that was talking to Moses out of the burning bush. And then God said also to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name. Now in English, we can't really pick it out, but I want you to look at your Bible real carefully at verse 15. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord. Now notice that word, Lord. Do you see anything different about that? The first letter L is a cap. Capital letter, but then the O, the R, and the D are also capital letters, but they're what's called small caps. In other words, this is the way that the English translators of the Hebrew have decided to show us as English readers that this right here is a very special name for God, the Lord. And if you're into this sort of thing, it's called the Tetragrammaton. The Tetragrammaton. It's four letters in Hebrew translated as Y, H, W, H. Now in Hebrew it would be Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey, but in English transliterated, what do those letters sound like? It's Y, H, W, H. Now when they come across this word in Hebrew, the English translators translate it as Lord. Large cap L, small cap O, R, and D. Have you ever noticed that before? So when you see that in your Bible, know that the word there, the Lord, we're referring to a very, very special word in Hebrew, YHWH. Hebrew scholars don't even know how to pronounce it. The best we can come up with is Yahweh. So what is God's name? And think about that. Well, his name is God. No, his name is YHWH. The best we know how to pronounce it is Yahweh. And Jews don't even pronounce the word. Instead, they say, when they read the Hebrew Bible, they substitute another word for it, say Adonai, which is just the word Lord. But really, the word is YHWH, Yahweh. That's the name of our God. And he said, when you go to talk to them, tell them that Yahweh has sent you. Now, the question is, what does the name mean? Well, one of the Bible scholars that I read said this, it means faithful presence. It's kind of based on the word ayah, which means I am. I'm here in the present. I will be in the future. Wherever you are, that's where I am. Faithful presence. That's the name of our God, Yahweh. And so God is telling him, Moses, who's dealing with this issue, well, I don't even know you. And God says, but I know you. I have been present with you from the very moment you were conceived in that little, and even when your mother placed you in that little basket on the Nile River. I was Yahweh. I was your faithful presence. But Moses is not through objecting with God. He said, well, wait a minute. What if they don't believe me? Look in verse 16. Let's go on. Chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? So Moses is thinking this through. Okay, God, you're going with me. You've appeared to me in this burning bush. You've told me you're going to be with me. You've given me your name. But what if? What if they don't believe me? What if I stand there and tell this story to them that, hey, this bush was burning and it didn't burn up and God spoke to me and told me to come here and we're gonna leave this place and I'm going to lead you into the promised land? And they all say, yeah, right. You're a nutcase. Certainly Pharaoh wouldn't have believed him. He's not going to let these people go. They're his favorite slaves. So God's response is this: what's in your hand? If Moses... The issue here is lack of influence. You know, I'm a nobody. They're not going to believe me. I have no influence. I have no sway. So what am I supposed to do? Walk into the palace of Pharaoh and say, okay, God came to me in a burning bush, and it's time for you to let my people go. And Pharaoh's just going to laugh at him. Who is this guy? He has no influence. If nothing else, he's got a criminal record. So what God is going to show to him is his power. So God says to him in verse 2 of chapter 4, then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? Moses replied, a staff. It's nothing but a staff, nothing but a stick. I've had it for most of my life here. I'm a shepherd. It looks like this. It goes up and it has kind of a crook at the top. And God says, okay, throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground and it became a snake and he ran away from it. He was terrified by what God had done. And the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. So God's going to show him his power. Now, what's really interesting is that God chose a very significant symbol to show his power. Because there's another shepherd's staff that the Pharaoh holds, and it looks something like this. If you notice, in the Pharaoh's hands are two items. One is a shepherd's crook. The other is what's called a flail. So the crook and the flail have been symbols of Pharaoh's power and authority for thousands of years, long before Moses came. Now, the crook is probably a symbol of the Pharaoh's authority. You know, he is in charge. He's the shepherd of the people of Egypt. And the flail looks kind of like a whip to me. And that's probably a symbol of Pharaoh's power. So he's got authority, and if you don't do what he says, he's going to beat on you. And isn't it interesting that God chose, as the staff of God, to put in Moses' hand the symbol of authority? And so Moses is going to go up to Pharaoh with the staff in his hand, and Pharaoh has a staff of his hand, a symbol of authority. Moses has the symbol of authority, and that's God's presence with him, and they're going to have a showdown in the chapters ahead. So God says, you've got my power. You've got this symbol of my authority, the staff of God. So with each of the questions, who am I? And then he says, they won't believe me. What if they don't believe me? And he says, what is your name? God gives him answers. At this point, Moses is out of questions. Instead, he's going to show what's probably what he thinks is the best excuse ever. Ever try to get out of something and you think, well, this excuse will definitely get me out of it? I mean, there's nothing that can argue with this one. This is a no fail. Moses has been saving this baby up for number 4. Ready? He says in verse 10, Go to chapter 4, verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "Oh Lord, I've never been eloquent." I can just hear him talking to the Lord. "Oh Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor in the future, nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue." Poor Moses lowers his head. You know, this is going to get me out of this. I know. All right, I'm slow of speech and tongue. You want me to go talk, and I can't even talk, you know. So literally the word is heavy of speech and heavy of tongue. Centuries ago, the Jewish rabbis concluded that maybe Moses had a speech impediment. Other Bible scholars say, well, it was just metaphorical, meaning that he was slow in responding or he was not very quick-witted. And if he stood before Pharaoh, he wouldn't have the right answers to give to Pharaoh. But I kind of like the idea of thinking that Moses kind of was a stutterer, you know, was a stammerer. It's hard to say exactly. But whatever it was, when he stood before Pharaoh, he had no confidence in his ability to speak. How many of you saw the film, The King's Speech? It came out a few years ago. Yeah, that was a great movie about King George VI. Had a terrible stutter, and he had to deliver a speech to his nation that was on the brink of war with Germany. Moses had this problem probably his entire life, going to school, you know, when he was young. "I've never been eloquent, neither in the past, nor since you've spoken." In other words, nothing's changed, dear God. I mean, you're picking the wrong guy for this job. Probably Moses thought that this defect would certainly disqualify him from what God was asking him to do. And sometimes we think the same thing. You know, we think that our disabilities, our defects disqualify us. When in reality, maybe it's those defects, maybe it's those disabilities that cause us to rely on God even more. Overcoming a disability is nothing for God. The issue is trust. Can you, an imperfect person, trust a perfect God to do something that's way beyond your abilities? History is full of people with disabilities that have done amazing things. Some of the world's greatest men and women have been saddled with disabilities and adversities. Cripple some and you have Sir Walter Scott. Lock some in a prison cell and you have John Bunyan. Bury him in the snows of Valley Forge and you have George Washington. Raise him in abject poverty and you have Abraham Lincoln. Burn him so severely in a schoolhouse fire that the doctors say he'll never walk again, and you've got a fellow by the name of Glenn Cunningham, who in 1934 set a world record in the mile. Deafen a genius composer, and you've got Beethoven. Have him born black in a society with racial discrimination, and you've got Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, Martin Luther King Jr. Make him the first child to survive in a poor Italian family of 18, and you've got Enrico Caruso. Have him born to parents who survived a Nazi concentration camp. Paralyze him from the waist down when he's 4, and you have the incomparable concert violinist named Itzhak Perlman. Call him a slow learner, retarded, write him off as uneducatable, and you have Albert Einstein. Banish him to the remotest wilderness and give him a criminal record and a speech problem and a terribly low self-esteem, and you have Moses, a man who launched a series of events that would change the course of nations and shape the destiny of millions. God doesn't care what kind of disability you have, what kind of defects that you may look at when you look in the mirror. All he wants you to do is to trust him, the perfect God, who can do beyond what you think he can do. Look in verse 4, chapter 4, let's read what the Lord says to Moses, who tells him, "But I can't speak." And the Lord says in verse 11, the Lord said to him, "Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind?" Now the Lord is asking questions. Moses is done asking questions. Now the Lord has a few questions of his own. "Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak. I will teach you what to say." Nothing is impossible for God. Trust me to do what you can't do. Finally, Moses, in a fit of despair, his fifth objection is this. really not an objection at all. Moses has a command for God. Can you believe the arrogance in a way? Now Moses is going to tell God what to do. But Moses said, "Oh Lord, please send somebody else to do it." I love this moment in Scripture's story. Here you have this weak-kneed, trembling man, 80 years old, before God himself, telling God, "Send somebody else." And here the issue is fear. That's really at the core of Moses' problem. That's what's sucking the life out of his ability to trust, is fear. "Please, Lord, send someone else." Verse 14, "And the Lord's anger burned against Moses, and he said, 'Okay, what about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well, and he's already on his way to meet you, and his heart will be glad when he sees you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will help both of you to speak and will teach you what to do. He'll speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take the staff in your hand so you can perform miraculous signs with it." And so God here, you feel like God's a little frustrated with Moses. And I don't think it's because God is angry at Moses necessarily so much as it's only because Moses is missing an opportunity for real deep healing in his life. He can experience God's healing power in the deepest areas of his fear and pain, and Moses won't go there with his faith. It's kind of like a child who gets hurt. I don't know if you've ever been around a little boy or a little girl that gets hurt, and mom wants to come alongside him and say, "Show me." And the little child goes, "No, you know, no. You know, well, let me just look at it." "No, you'll touch it." "I won't touch it, I promise. I won't touch it. Let me just look at it." And the little child just kind of holds out his hand like this, just barely holding it out. Finally, the mommy gets to heal it. And it's almost like Moses is like that with God. "Don't look at it, my fear. Don't touch it." And God says to Moses, "Oh, there's so much more for you." The great thing about Moses is that he does grow. He is transformed. Later on in Scripture, Stephen said of Moses, he was powerful in speech and action. He was powerful in speech and action. I don't think Stephen was just making this up to make Moses look good. I think Moses went through a period of transformation after he met God and he began to trust. The story concludes with verse 18. "Then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, 'Let me go back to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive.'" Isn't that funny? Moses doesn't even tell him what he's going to do. "Well, God came to me in a burning bush. I'm supposed to go back there and free my people. So I'll be back with about 1 million folks in a few days." He says, "No, I just want to go back and see if they're alive, you know." So Moses goes. He finally goes. Of all the people that God could have chosen to liberate, over 1 million slaves from the iron grasp of one of the most powerful men in the world who led the most powerful armies in the world, he picked Moses. Defeated, self-doubting, inadequate, slow-talking, timid, weak-kneed, imperfect Moses. God tends to pick the least liking men and women to accomplish his will. He picks the youngest like David, the orphan like Esther, the roughest like Peter, the orneriest like Jonah, to be the instruments in his hands. And he picks you and me as well. In fact, when he picks the most impressive people like Saul and Samson, they turn out to be the least successful. The reason is this: it's not the tool. It's the touch of the master that creates the masterpiece. A perfect God is not limited by our imperfections. Rather, through our weaknesses, he shows his power even more. And you know what? I think he has fun doing it. God works with the broken tools to do something way beyond what they could ever imagine that they could do. And in the end, it wasn't his great training in Egypt. It wasn't the Egypt's version of MIT and Stanford and Harvard that prepared Moses the best for his leadership position. It was Moses' failures and wilderness wanderings that was the best training for his leadership, because through that, he learned to trust God and take him at his word. As we reflect on Moses' story, I want to throw up just one last slide here. Where do you see yourself on this list? Negative self-image? Maybe I don't know God that well. Maybe I lack authority or influence. People don't listen to me. How am I supposed to be any kind of influence? Maybe I lack authority. Maybe I'm struggling with some inability. Like Moses, you think, well, you know, I don't know how to do this or that. Maybe in the underneath it all is fear. But notice what God does on his side. God provides us his promise, I'll be with you. He reveals himself in his person. He moves with power in ways that you can't even begin to imagine. And he offers possibility in the face of our impossibilities. He'll create what is needed by what we have. And then there are times when fear grips us so much that God says, okay, I'll send you a supportive partner. You know, the text doesn't say what happened to the bush after Moses left. Perhaps that old bush is still ablaze somewhere in the wilderness of our own fear and failure. The remote place where we go to disappear and forget our past. Maybe that's the place where you'll find your burning bush, God's presence. Here in the desert of our deepest pain burns the fire of God's call. Don't be afraid to come near and feel the heat and experience his healing power. Real transformation. I'm going to read one more verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18. It says this, and when we with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory are being transformed into his likeness with ever-increasing glory which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit. Where can you get that strength, that power, that presence of God? It's being in the presence of God himself, the glory of God, and it transforms us into his likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit himself. I really believe that that's where we need to go to experience our transformation, is in the presence of God.